From WXXI News, this is Weekend Connections, the podcast. Thanks for joining us. I'm Evan Dawson.
And I'm Megan Mack. We're going to open the podcast with a clip from a conversation that we admit we never really expected to have. The subject was punching Nazis.
Yeah, there's been a rash of viral video clips, people punching Nazis on city streets. There was one from Seattle this week where a guy just got laid out, I mean, knocked unconscious with a tooth flying. And maybe you see those kind of clips and cheer, maybe you laugh, maybe you share them, but do you think violence against Nazis, against white supremacists, is the right way to send a message?
We talked to RIT ethics professor Lawrence Turcello, along with Kit Miller. She's the director of the Gandhi Center for Nonviolence. And in this clip, you'll hear a caller who opened up about how she has struggled with this issue herself. Let's listen.
I wanted to share an experience I had when I first heard about the attack in Charlottesville. I had the radio on, as I always do, and I was only kind of half listening. And when I first heard the story, I thought that what happened was that someone had driven their car into the white supremacist protesters. And I remember thinking to myself, yeah, finally, you know, finally we're getting one back at them. And then I had to kind of stop and think, wait a minute, is that how I really feel about this? And then, of course, I heard the correct story, and it was kind of an eye-opening moment for me.
Do you feel the same way then momentarily when you see those videos of you know, the viral videos of the people punching Nazis? Do you have those moments where you say, yeah, I got what you deserved?
I have to admit I haven't seen those.
Okay. But
I have heard, you know, I have heard a lot on this topic just listening to NPR all day on different programs. And, you know, I don't know how I feel about it.
Well, Carrie, why don't you hang there for a second? And, Professor, I'll start with you. What do you make of her sort of wrestling with that momentary, hey, good, you know, that kind of that visceral feeling that happens, yeah, and then kind of pulling back a little?
Well, thank you for sharing that. And I think we're always making moral choices. And I think that, you know, and I share this impulse so many people have to want to punch Nazis. I get that. I really do. That's visceral. And whenever something feels so visceral that you should do it, and that's probably when we need to take a step back and actually apply some critical thought aimed at ourselves. And so I think that's just part of being a moral person, is to not go with your impulse all the time. We have good and bad impulses. We have to check them with our intellect.
Kit, how do you feel about it?
I'm just pulling up a little quote from the only person that I know that was an eyewitness to Charlottesville is a rabbi named Mordecai Liebling. He lost his entire extended family in a Holocaust. So I think you can make a decent argument that compared to most people in this country, Rabbi Liebling has the most reason and rationale to want to punch a Nazi. And Liebling said something very different. He said, "We are faced with a difficult challenge. We cannot tolerate white supremacy, and we must listen to the fear and pain that many of its supporters carry. These are the fears of the rank-and-file followers, and contrary to the facts of wealth, income, or education, they believe they are losing ground relative to non-white groups. It's the work of those white people who are able to hear their pain to attempt to reach over barriers and advocate for policies that will benefit them as well. Dehumanizing and dismissing them leads to more hatred. We will not bring about a more just society through violence." So I defer to Rabbi Liebling. Like, if he, again, someone I know, that if he said, yes, we should go punch Nazis, my family was killed by them, and this, like, latter-day resurgence of them is intolerable, then I would be far more inclined to go with the ideas. But this guy actually, for me, stands for the people that have truly lost through fascism and still are willing to stand for the values of the kind of things that we've been talking about, what this society is built on.
All right, so this is someone clearly vulnerable and has lost. So Carrie, you know, I guess as you conclude the conversation today, do you know in your head, I mean, do you feel any sort of conclusion on where you stand on the issue now?
Yeah, definitely. And I do remember feeling, after that initial impression that I had, feeling a little embarrassed, because normally people, what I consider my side of the argument, don't act like that. And so I thought, wait a minute, what, you know, how come all of a sudden, you know, this side is being violent? So I do. But it was very interesting to me that my initial, you know, impression was, oh, good, finally, you know, but no. Mm.
Can I just say something? I just really appreciate you, Carrie, because like there's a kind of empathy that we're looking for sometimes, and we've been educated to think that other people being harmed sometimes can give us that sense of relief or a sense of like somehow that I can feel better through that. And I'm celebrating that you were able to see through that actually that's not the right medicine for the pain. Thank you.
Next, the number of students studying abroad continues to climb, even though we see increased concern about terrorism, instability, and the world economy. We talked about that, and we met a student named Jacqueline Tran from the University of Rochester, who saw her own travel abroad schedule impacted by ISIS.
But that did not deter her. Here's the story about her experience and the value she sees in immersing in other cultures.
I originally had planned to go to Egypt, actually, but somewhere in November, you know, the University of Rochester was concerned for my safety, so because of political conflicts that were in the region, in that area, I was relocated and applied to Jordan instead. And then conveniently enough, when I had booked my flight and I applied to my program, ISIS had claimed that they organized an attack in December, which was a police shooting of 10 Jordanian policemen. So I had to relocate again to Morocco. So it wasn't necessarily planned, but at the same time, it was a great experience nonetheless.
Remind me again, how long you were in Morocco?
I was in Morocco from January to May. Then I came back to New York for 2 weeks, and then I went back there over the summer.
What is the overall characterization of that experience? When your friends and fellow classmates want to know, really, was it worth it to you? What did you gain from it? Did you enjoy it on a daily and weekly basis? What would you say?
Yeah, actually, it's funny. Many people have asked me, you know, how Morocco was. And it's such, I think for most people that study abroad, there's so many different experiences that you have. You cannot sum it up in one sentence or one word. I definitely think my heart beats stronger for that country now. I think that's the best way to put it. Not necessarily that I am totally in love with the place, but there is a familiarity and a comfort that I appreciate. And there are people back there that I have established close relationships with that I'm willing to return to. And I think that experience that I've had there is just, I mean, it's, you know, cheesy enough to say it was life-changing. And it really steered me in a clearer path than it ever has before. So I'd say it's definitely worth it, and I would never go back.
Jacqueline, I mentioned that comment from a study abroad director at the University of Pittsburgh saying that these programs actually make the world safer. You know, for a moment, set aside our concerns about safety, which are legitimate and important, but the actual experience of studying abroad makes the world safer. Do you agree with that?
I do agree with that, because I think there's only so much you can pick up from media. You know, media is basically constructed in a very specific kind of way. And especially when we're dealing with Islamic countries, we only hear what the media wants us to hear. But when you go there for yourself, you really have your own judgment that you can really pick up from yourself and your own experiences and, you know, come to a conclusion that is not necessarily as skewed from like a higher power. I think it's more mindful in a way.
Yeah. What were the biggest differences as you saw them in terms of media presentation versus what you were experiencing in Morocco?
Media presentations were, I mean, you know, it's always about violence. Like, Islam is violence. And it's only like the biggest attacks that, it's like Islam, ISIS, and Arabs, like that's in violence and, you know, they're a threat. It's like kind of like the Cold War and communism all over again, you know? But when you go there, it's, you know, it's some people are Muslim and some people aren't. There are people who drink and smoke, even though they claim to be Muslim. There are, you know, people that are young and youthful and don't wear the hijab and, you know, are creating music and really just living their lives. And they're not so different from us. And I think that's just something that, you know, we have to just humanize them. And I think that when you go there and you live there for such a long time while simultaneously studying their culture and their religion, you also see it in person. You see that these people have access to YouTube and Facebook, and it's a globalized society. They're not so different from us after all. But at the same time, they do have their own culture. So I think the biggest thing is that, you know, when you study abroad, it's, you know, people are humanized and people are really just people.
Next, the debate over Sean Spicer's appearance at the Emmys. The former White House spokesman mocked himself on the Emmys, drawing laughs and cheers. He posed for pictures with celebrities, and the New York Times reports that Spicer is hoping to leverage that appearance to gain speaking gigs and more media exposure.
But many people were bothered by the Emmys' decision to let Spicer have some fun, and our panel discussed the broader question of whether we should blend politics, journalism, and entertainment like we see at the White House Correspondents' Dinner. In this clip, we will start with the comedian Hasan Minhaj, who hosted the Correspondents' Dinner this year. And then you'll hear local comedian and activist Chris Thompson, followed by artist-at-large Linda Starkweather.
I was asked to not roast the president and the administration in their absentia. And I completely understand that. We are in a very strange situation where there's a very combative relationship between the press and the president. But now that you guys are minorities, just for this moment, you might understand the position I was in it. And it's the same position a lot of minority kids feel in this country. And it's, you know, do I come up here and just try to fit in and not ruffle any feathers? Or do I say how I really feel? Because this event is about celebrating the First Amendment and free speech. Free speech is the foundation of an open and liberal democracy. From college campuses to the White House, only in America can a first-generation Indian-American Muslim kid get on this stage and make fun of the president. The orange man behind the Muslim ban. And it's a sign to the rest of the world. It's this amazing tradition that shows the entire world that even the president is not beyond the reach of the First Amendment.
That's Hasan Minhaj, who was speaking at the White House Correspondents' Dinner. Chris Thompson, agree or disagree?
I kind of agree. Like, he's speaking to something that a lot of people think. In fact, I was going to make my own podcast called Things Black Folk Been Telling You That You're Just Learning Right Now. And like
things like white people are like, I can't believe it. And all the people of color around them are like, yeah, oh, you can't believe it? I only told you this for years?
Yeah.
Great.
Yeah. Like the whole premise of what he was saying, or the whole message of what he's saying about like assimilating in or you just, you know, throwing everything out the window. You know, that's something that a lot of people deal with, especially minorities, mm-hmm. pretty much every day. And like him having that platform to say that is pretty unique. You know, I would have never imagined, even with Donald Trump, you not going to the thing, to have, you know, a Muslim immigrant, child of immigrants, like at the White House Correspondents' Dinner. Like that was absolutely amazing to me. So,
Linda, what do you think?
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of voices that have been silenced for a long time. And, you know, it always comes down to whose truth is it. But if we don't listen to each other's truth is where we get in trouble. And just lest you think I don't have a sense of humor, I have a joke on perception. Perception is reality, right? So, because I think our perception is part of the problem here. We're just so stuck in our own need to be right and our way of thinking. So a guy walks into a psychiatrist's office with a duck on his head. The duck says, hey, can you get this guy off my butt? Ba-dum-bum, shh. All right. Silly joke, you know, that Henny Youngman, you know, kind of joke. But the fact is that we're all so wedded to our own perceptions and our own realities of how the world works, and we're not listening to each other. And, you know, to listen, to drop your own perception or to decide you're not going to be, we're like compulsively defending our position as the right position. And to be wrong is to succumb to a kind of psychic or egoic death, which is why people won't even listen to the other side. It is too threatening to our egos to even say, oh, maybe you do have a point. So, yeah, so humor can help us get there, maybe. I don't know.
Let's close with a question. Would you ever run for political office? Yes, you. After the national election last November, we saw a surge of interest in grassroots organizing, marches, demonstrations, and in citizens running for local office, school board, town board, city council. In Rochester, we saw more than a dozen people run for 5 at-large city council seats.
One of those people was Mary Lupien. She's a teacher and a climate activist with an organization called Mothers Out Front. Lupien lost. Barely, she finished in 6th place when the top 5 made the cut. But she told us she doesn't want other citizens to be discouraged by that result.
Well, I had been kind of in this slow progression. It started 2.5 years ago when I got involved with Mothers Out Front and leading and speaking at rallies, speaking out against climate change. And I really found out how much I had to say. And so I kept going, and that happened right around the same time as the Bernie Sanders campaign came to town. And I felt so inspired and was really feeling like I had a place in you know, speaking about these issues, that I kind of rolled that energy and passion right into the Bernie Sanders campaign, where I was a delegate and a legal organizer. And that kind of experience really showed me kind of inside the political realm. And the whole message of that campaign was, if you want social change, that you have to stand up and run for office and become a decision maker. And so, you know, as that campaign ended in New York so dramatically, I really felt called to continue. And especially at that time, to give people that next step when with such a devastating loss, not to lose hope that this, you know, is never about a single campaign, but it's about continuing a movement for social change. And that's what we did.
What would you say to others who are also thinking about a run? There's been a consistent refrain since last November that more average citizens should get involved and run for local office. You did that. What would you say to others who are also considering it?
I would say that, you know, it took me 4 times of someone saying you should run for office to really internalize it and believe that it could be me, and then to see myself as someone that can do that. So I'm going to tell you, you should run for office. It's not easy. It's a lot of work. And it, you know, especially if you have a family, it will take you away from them. It will be tough on every, you know, imaginable place in your life. But it's also an incredible experience and worth it. So what I was hoping to inspire in people is that people could look at me and see me and say, hey, if she can do it, I can do it too. And it's absolutely true. You know, I am, you know, I'm a mom, I'm a substitute teacher, I'm an activist, I'm not a politician. And you don't have to be a politician to run for office. And I encourage you to try.
So even at the local level, incumbents tend to do very well. Going back to primary night, and even before that, in the middle of your campaign, how confident were you, and did your team expect to win?
I think we always knew that we had a very good chance. There are a lot of factors in this election that made it, I don't think anybody was confident that they were going to win. There was just so many players with name recognition, and even people who are veterans in this political game had no idea. So, you know, we always knew that we had a very strong chance and that we were fighting for 5th spot, knowing that some of the people with a higher name recognition had a much more likely chance to win. But we, you know, what we planned for was to get 6,500 votes. And in last election for city council at large, that would have won it. And we got 6,598, which, so we absolutely did what we set out to do.
What was the most rewarding and what was the most disappointing aspect about this race?
The most rewarding was the relationships that I've built. And, you know, I guess it shouldn't have been such a surprise, but that relationship building is such an integral part of running for office, and how the relationships that I built early on really helped propel me later. And just, you know, the people that I touched that have either never donated to a political campaign before or never thought that the system and had really cared about their voice and their vote, and the people that just really opened up and welcomed me into their lives was incredible. The biggest disappointment, I guess, is just still how broken our party is. You know, coming from an outside perspective and realizing that this is how things work was really disappointing. And I have been saying for a while now that to really revamp the Democratic Party, we have got to put our committee members, of which there are 1,200 in the county, we've got to get them out on the street, building those relationships in their own districts so that they can have their finger on the pulse of what's going on, let people know how they can get involved, keep people informed on issues and how their government works. Because many, many, many people, you know, will come up to me and say, I'm really ashamed. You know, I don't really know what city council does. And I would say, well, you're with the majority of people in Rochester, and we have got to change that.
And that will do it for this edition of Weekend Connections, the podcast. Megan Mack is going to spend the entire weekend resting and recovering. How are you feeling?
I'm okay. Sorry I sound a little stuffy, everybody.
A little bit, but you know, it's been a long week.
It has.
And Megan actually has a very busy weekend, so we wish her well at the Fringe Festival. Hope you've been enjoying the Fringe Festival in our community. By the time you hear this podcast, the Fringe Festival will probably be over.
Womp womp.
But either way, have a great weekend. We're back with you Monday on WXXI AM 1370, WRUR 88.5 FM, WEOS Finger Lakes Public Radio 89.5 FM.
And the WXXI mobile app. Have a great weekend, everybody. Blah.
Yeah, there it is.
There it is.
We're
There's my sickness.
We're not doing this again.
Have a great weekend, everyone. We'll talk to you Monday.